Welcome to the Leader Manager Coach Podcast, your weekly podcast where we take a deep dive examining knowledge, philosophies, wisdom and insight to help you to lead, manage and coach in football, sports and life. Leader Manager Coach is presented by Rob Riles. Rob is a qualified coach with a League Managers Association qualification and a science and medicine background. He has worked in the football industry in Europe, USA and Africa at international, premiership, league, non-league and grassroots levels with World Cup and European Championship experience.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Leader Manager Coach. It's Rob Riles and welcome to another edition. Today I'm really excited to have somebody with me that has been a good friend of mine, somebody that I hold in really high esteem. He's had a real esteemed career as a non-league footballer. He's a coach educator, and he's worked in international football and worked in Europe as a coach, and it's somebody that I know has got vast amounts of experience. So I'm really pleased to introduce a guy called Steve Rutter. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm great, and thanks for coming along. The reason I've asked you to come along is because obviously we've worked together in the past, and I've been fortunate enough during our work time just to sit and have coffee with you, tea with you, work out on the grass with you, and see how you coach players, see how you educate coaches. And what I wanted to do is see if I can access, just for a short period of time, some of your knowledge so that we can perhaps share that with some of the folks who are listening. So just a little bit of backstory. I know that you played for Yeovil as a player. So if just as a start, just tell us a little bit about your playing career and how you got from there into your coaching to begin with.
Well, I think you summed up my playing career there. I played a bit for Yeovil. The reality was I was a non-league footballer. I did go to Yeovil at the time. They were in the Ryman League or the Isthmian League. But I actually went as a full-time player eventually.
Right.
And I was the only one. They were in a transition period. So okay. it was quite lonely during the daytime. And the manager at the time was a fella called Brian Hall.
Yeah.
Who in non-league circles was a real genius. He'd taken Wealdstone to the what was the Gola League, it's now the National League,
yeah,
but he'd
yeah.
won the Gola League FA Trophy double in the same season.
Yeah.
And Wealdstone are a small team even in non-league terms. So I went to work with him, and he was a person really who got me into coaching as well, because when I went to Yeovil full-time, he said to me, look, you know, I've got you here full-time because I think you're a good athlete, you can kick people. You're not the best with the ball, which was true. He said, but I think you'll make a much better coach than you ever will a player, so you should really think about getting into coaching early.
And how old were you then, Steve, when you started that journey?
Oh, about 24.
Right.
24, so 25.
Quite young,
yeah, to be told you're not good enough as a footballer at that
age. Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, become a coach in rubbish as a player. But he was spot on, to be fair. And I think deep down I knew that anyway, because I always felt a bit pressurised when I played. I was always a bit scratchy. My techniques were never really pure. You know, and I see some players and they're just effortless. But I was all about physical effort and tackling and heading and kicking. But I did have a good football brain. And I think he recognised that quite early, and that's why he suggested I get into coaching.
Okay. So after you'd kind of got to that point where somebody had said to you, look, I think coaching would be possibly a niche for you, did you start straight away with your own education moving at that age?
Well, that probably already started, because I left the police force to go to Yeovil, and in the police force I'd specialised as an instructor.
Right.
So I'd done physical education, self-defence, first aid drill, and part of the physical education programme was all sorts of different sports. So I'd already done
right.
football coaching badges. But I carried on playing, and then took my prelim badge and eventually my full badge, and set up a youth training programme. So I stayed as a full-time player by definition of my contract,
yeah.
but the club found other things for me to do. So I started to get into the coaching side whilst I was still playing.
Okay.
And I think, like you said earlier, just being around Brian Hall, sitting talking, I mean, you started the process of coaching because you were taking on information that maybe you didn't realise, and it was already starting to shape your thinking. So
okay, Brian Hall isn't somebody that I actually know. So what was it about him, just briefly, that makes you say, you know, he was a name or a legend in non-league circles? What was good about him?
Well, I mean, we spoke before he came on air about Dick Bate. the thing I found in my coaching career as I've gone through it is there's always been lots of people that have known much more about football than me. And it's not necessarily their football knowledge that attracts me to them. It's what they're like as people.
Yeah, yeah.
And Brian and Dick Bay, who, as you know, sadly passed away, both of them shared really similar characteristics in terms of their great people, great humans, real dedicated to their craft,
yeah.
Always got time for people. And Brian, as I say, and Dick shared those, but Brian worked in an environment of non-league football where, given the resources he had at his disposal at Wealdstone, for example, to win the Gola League and the FA Trophy in the same season is the non-league equivalent of Leicester winning the Premier League.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But it's the way he was as a person that, for me, really separated him. And so when he said to me, like, become a coach, I believe what he was saying.
So it was his people skills and his character over and above his, maybe his tactical or technical knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I even now I split up coaching into four competencies, whether you're a coach educator or a coach of players.
Yeah.
And they're the same four competencies. You just vary how you apply them in the circumstances. You know, number one is emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And I think maybe historically in English football, that's been a little bit lacking, particularly in professional coaching. It's been such a macho sort of business. It's all about he's a footballer. Well, actually, the footballers are people first.
Yeah.
I think maybe the foreign coaches have a slight head start because they come from a slightly different perspective. Yeah. But emotional intelligence would be something, I think, if you looked at people like Dick Bay, if you looked at Brian Hall, you looked at the really good coaches you see, I think a lot of people would say that's one of their number one qualities.
Yeah.
They can relate to people, they can engage with people, and they can inspire people.
Yeah. So that would be the where Brian Hall was high on that spectrum for you, yeah.
Well, he was high on that, but my four competencies, for example, are emotional intelligence, organisation, and logistical skill. So managing human and physical resources.
Yeah.
He was outstanding at that.
Yeah.
Your subject specific knowledge. In our case, it's football. His knowledge of football was encyclopedic.
Is that your number three?
Like Dick. Yeah. One of the three, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the fourth one is like the pedagogical skills, you know, your skills to teach and communicate the information to people so they can learn. Those three sit just below the emotional intelligence. So numbers two, three and four are really equal.
Although, is that set of four something that you've come up with yourself? Obviously, they're not unique, you know, in themselves because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realise that if you're going to be good at something, you've got to have a detailed knowledge of that.
Yeah.
And if you're going to work with, unless you're going to lock yourself away in a laboratory and be Einstein, you've got to get on with people at some point. And if you're in an organisation, you've got to utilise the resources successfully.
Yeah.
So, but are those four things that you've drawn down, Steve, and look at as real, the four legs of the table, if I can use that analogy, is that something you've come up with yourself?
That's my four.
Yeah.
Whether somebody else somewhere else in the world has got those four written down as well, I don't know.
But they are your,
But from my experiences, those are the four things that I've highlighted. I mean, when I was younger, I probably didn't recognise the fact that I was going to Brian, who was like a mentor, really, my first mentor.
Yeah.
Dick Bate would be my second mentor. You know, I'm 55 now, and they're obviously significantly older than me, but they were both my mentors. And as I said, lots of people had more of the technical and tactical knowledge about football than I did when I started coaching, but I didn't go to those people because I didn't like their human qualities. You know, it was that other human side, the emotional intelligence side of Dick, of Brian, that attracted me to them.
So when you look back, would you say in hindsight that that's why they became the mentors to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, 100%.
So,
and what they were good at doing was adapting it. You know, I've seen both Brian and Dick do sessions with 8-year-olds on a park. And they've got an encyclopedic knowledge of football tactics and skills and systems of play and everything. And actually, they go out and put on a fantastic session for an eight-year-old. And the eight-year-olds come off giggling, laughing, because they're there for a different reason. And coaching is something different in that context.
So they can actually adapt to do that and not just go out and do a Champions League session, be on a Thursday before the game, on a Saturday, if I could, you know, so that,
yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And that's one of the things. You've got those four competencies, and then everything is, for me, is situationally specific. So you have to adapt.
Yeah.
You know, and an 8-year-old who just wants to turn with a ball doesn't need to be taught like he's playing in the Premier League. He just wants to run around and turn with a football.
Yeah.
So treat him accordingly.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. So just on your story then, there you are and you've started and you've gone and got your full badge. Were you still at Yeovil at that point when you got your full badge?
Ironically, I I got asked to be caretaker. Brian got sacked, which was a real shame because he was fantastic. And we got another manager come in who didn't last very long, and I got asked to take over as caretaker manager. And it's one of those, you know, if you don't take it, we'll have to get somebody from outside. So I took it for 8 games. I didn't have an A licence at the time. I was booked on the course. It was the full badge in those days. It was called the full badge. And I was booked on the course at the end of that season. So we had 8 games. The first game, we'd got back into the conference. We were playing Slough at home. It was a hurricane all day long. We were 5-0 up at half time. We won 7-2. Even the goalkeeper scored for us. And everybody said, oh, this management lark's really easy.
Easy, isn't it?
Yeah. So I got offered the job at the end of the season because I think we won 4, drew 2 of those 8 games. Stayed up quite comfortably.
Yeah.
And then they offered me the manager's job. So I actually took the manager's job before I'd actually got the A licence.
Yeah.
And to be honest, when I look back on it now, I was never equipped to become a manager at that moment in time.
And when you look back, what were the reasons for that, would you say?
Because managing is different from coaching.
Right.
First of all, you know, being a field coach, being a number two somewhere and being responsible for going out and coaching players every day around the tactics and the principles of the game is different from dealing with the board, dealing with the agents, dealing with the media. I had no preparation for doing that whatsoever. I just thought I could wing it, like most people do. And I did all right, to be fair. For 2.5 years, we did well. But I can't say, other than one game against Arsenal in the FA Cup third round, I can't say I actually enjoyed a game.
You didn't enjoy any of the games?
Not really, no.
Because of the stress of it?
Yeah, I was either relieved because we'd got a result we needed or devastated because we hadn't.
Interesting. I remember John Rudge, who was Port Vale for 19 years, and he said exactly the same as that, Steve. He said, I never enjoyed one game. He said, the only emotion I ever felt that was any good was relief. And in a way, I suppose that's a little bit of an indictment about what the game's about in terms of the pressure, but you could look at it and say, well, actually, you know, you can understand why some people don't pursue it.
Yeah, and you know, it's context, isn't it? Because I was at Yeovil. We were in the National League, as it is now, the conference. If I got sacked, I probably needed to go and get a job on the following week because you don't earn the sort of money that you do. You know, I'm not V.S. Boas. I wish I was. So you get a good job. And the only reason I enjoyed the Arsenal game was because the club were bankrupt at the time. We got to the third round of the FA Cup. It was on television. We made a fortune out of it. It saved the club from bankruptcy. And I could sit back and say, at least we're all going to get paid for the rest of the season.
Still gonna keep going.
But I have to say, genuinely, I can't remember enjoying a game. It was just relief or devastation.
So at that point, you were obviously coaching players in your role as manager and coach. How did you then get from there into your coach education? Was that your next career movement after that?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really linear. It wasn't clear like that. Lots of overlaps at different times with things happening. So I got involved with the FA when I was still at Yeovil.
Yeah.
The regional director was a fellow called Dave Burnside, who again, unfortunately, has passed away. A very, very good coach, an inspirational technical coach. Well ahead of his time in terms of some of the stuff he wanted to do. And he got me involved in FA programmes. And he got me onto the A licence as a member of support staff.
Yeah.
And then shortly after, when I left Yeovil, I got involved with delivering coaching courses because it was a different system then. You didn't go through a process of training to become a tutor. You had if you had your A licence badge, you could deliver a pre-M badge.
Yeah.
And so basically, they said, look, you're in the Southwest. You know, there's not many people down there who do coach education.
Yeah. Take it
on. Do you fancy doing a bit?
Yeah.
And so it sort of evolved into that, really.
Okay.
But I carried on managing and coaching in semi-professional football at lower levels at Trowbridge, and then just gradually increased the amount of work I did on the coaching courses, particularly the prelim course, which at the time was the lower level of course.
Okay. I mean, my kind of association or friendship with you, Steve, was as it really started as when you were a coach educator and I was working as a staff member on the team. So I've seen you day after day and week after week, sun, rain, breaking your leg, getting it misdiagnosed, stopping somebody selling was out of the back of a car, all that kind of stuff. So we've seen all that weeks and weeks and weeks and years of it. And, you know, without, this isn't about me, you know, saying, you know, who's great and who's not. But Steve, you know, I've been blown away. I really have been blown away at times with you know, the detail that you were able to come across with. And I'm sure you'll say, well, I couldn't do that at the beginning, and I've evolved into that. But you, for me, as somebody who had this admirable ability, as somebody who wanted to progress in coaching myself and wanted to do his A license and wanted to go on, I used to watch from the side, and I'd see you diagnose a phase of play, if I can use that technical term, and then come up with this simple solution that changed the whole picture. Now, there might be people listening to this who think, blimey, I don't know what all that's all about. But did you just perhaps tell us, as through your journey, did you go through that process yourself of seeing things that maybe Brian could do or Dick could do that you thought, flipping heck, I can't do that, I couldn't see that, and they came up with the answer? And do you remember going through that process where it became, or you got more clarity with it yourself?
Yeah, I think there's two strands to it as well, I think. I mean, as I've got older, I've started to look at things away from football and like what I call a genetic predisposition for certain things.
Yeah.
And I think some people are born with it. You know, I was never going to be an elite footballer for whatever reason, no matter how hard I tried. But I'd got some of the elements, and like the game understanding part of it was one of those. Like I said earlier, I had a good football brain, but I'd necessarily good football techniques. Yeah. And I think maybe I was born with some of that sort of genetic potential. And having really good mentors like Brian and Dick helped smooth my progression through. Yeah. But it's like anybody who's an expert at anything, you know, if you, and I use expert term loosely because it doesn't mean you get it right all the time. Yeah. It just means you're considered to be very experienced in the field. But if you talk to somebody who rides motorbikes really fast for a living, they say when they go around corners, everything seems like it's in slow motion because they're just so familiar with it all. They can predict the patterns of things that are going to happen. And I think you end up doing that. So you're right.
Do you think that comes from... are you saying that, yes, if you see 1,000 pictures compared to 10,000, obviously the person who's seen 10,000 is likely, let's use that word, to be able to see more?
No.
Or are you saying...
No.
Not saying that?
No, I think if you have a genetic predisposition for it, you might see 500 pictures and recognise it quickly.
Right.
Somebody else can see 10,000 pictures and never see it ever. Makes sense to them.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that. You've seen it on the courses with candidates. And there's been a few who have been absolutely fantastic characters who have worked their socks off and done every single thing possible to get themselves through an assessment at A-licence level.
Yeah.
But everybody who's watched them said they're not an A-licence coach.
Yeah.
You know, because they just can't. They haven't got it, whatever it is. And I think where I was deficient as a player... maybe I was accelerated as a coach and I could see the pictures really quickly.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, it's, you know, we're all based around pattern recognition. The human brain is designed to recognise patterns quickly and efficiently and to ignore irrelevant cues.
Yes.
And I think what my brain's learnt to do within football context is to see the important triggers quickly, forget all the fluff, and that helps you come to a really quick decision about things rather than people who can't really see the triggers. And so they have to come up with 6 or 7 solutions before they get anywhere near the one that's actually going to work.
Yeah. I've also worked with tutors who are, what, from my perspective, as somebody watching it or even being somebody being assessed, if I'm the person who's being assessed, who are absolutely brilliant at diagnosing, but I haven't been able to grasp what they're telling me. So they know it, but they can't get it over to... Is that something that you found easy to do, to actually get the message over?
Not always.
No.
I mean, you know, I have this horrible habit, and it may even have come across on here, that when I get into a subject matter, I get quite quick and quite excited.
Yeah.
And a few of the other tutors have been standing on the side doing the throat-slitting motion. Basically, shut up. But I think... The art, I suppose, of being really good at something is you can take something that's complicated and present it in very simple terms.
Yeah.
You know? So, and I think that's experience, maybe that innate disposition for it, plus the experience, you become better at taking the very complicated thing and putting it in very simple terms.
Yeah.
Because you have to grade it down for people's understanding.
Yeah.
Once they've got the basic, the fundamentals or the principles of it, you can then start to give them more complicated examples and make it more challenging.
Yeah. Okay. So also looking at the game, if we just take football, because that's what we're talking about, do you think you have a predisposition to coaching in the game compared to coaching for the game? Is that would be your preference to do that, or you're not, again, like talking about Dick can be go to 8 year olds or a pro team? Does it matter to you? Are you
no it doesn't really. It depends where you are, because you know you do some team coaching sessions and they're okay and you get through them. Some you enjoy more than you enjoy others, and I can go and coach techniques and have a fantastic time doing that. Your brain's working differently, really, in the two. One, you're responding to things that are happening as a result of the free flow of the game, and the other one, to a large degree, you're predetermining how you're going to build the session up and how you're going to move it on, and you know the rough range of variation that you're going to get. I'll do this practice, it will probably take 6 or 7 minutes, and then maybe I can move on to something like this. You know, it's not always specific. I just enjoy coaching, you know, and I was having a conversation with somebody earlier today, and those four competencies we spoke about earlier, they're absolutely prerequisites whether you're coaching players or you're coaching coaches.
Yeah.
Those four things, if you haven't got one of them, you're dead. You really are. You need some of them, you know, to a degree of all of them in each situation. What was I going to say? I've lost my train of thought there, really.
That's okay.
I was just, because I was thinking about you need that. We'll come back to it because it'll come to me in a flash in a moment.
So out of all the coaching spectrum, whether that's coaching in the game, you know, scenarios, free kicks, I don't know, front third or defending third or coaching techniques, what is it that gives you the biggest thrill or the biggest amount of pleasure or the greatest feedback when you think, do you know what, that's been a brilliant day that has? Or is there anything specific for you?
No, there isn't. I mean, when I worked at Panathinaikos, I can remember going out. I had three young lads who were all defenders. And I'll give you their names if you want, but it's a real name. One of them was called Kostadinos Triantafilopoulos.
Right.
Hell of a name, that.
Are you fluent in Greek now?
I couldn't survive, basically. So there was him, a boy called Diamanti Hohoumis and Marinakis, who were all young defenders and fullbacks. And we were going to do an extra session on the pitch just on defending 1v1 in wide areas. So you know it's going to be explosive, it's going to be short blocks of work for them, because that only happens 4 or 5 seconds at a time maximum, you know. And there's three of them to rotate around. And I went onto the pitch to get set up, and it just started lashing down with rain. So I'm hiding in the hut, the equipment hut. The main changing room block's 200-300 yards away. And it's lashing, and the sky's black and that. And I'm thinking, you know, there's no way we're going to take this session. And then suddenly I hear this giggling, and these three lads come in running across the fields because they're so desperate to get out on the fields and play. So we did an hour and a bit, just the three of us, those three and me, out on the pitch. And it was absolutely magnificent.
Yeah.
You know, so I got as much joy out of that as I do out of going to do an 11v11 session, playing through the thirds.
That works. Gets it with an object and finishes with a...
Well, it's ideal. You're doing playing out from the back, and you play out from the back, 15 passes, and you smash one in the top corner, everybody claps and says, get off. There's just something there's an intrinsic joy and value in coaching and communicating with the players or the team.
So I think that goes back to the humanistic character thing, doesn't it? It's not just about how can you get that person to be great at this, it's the feedback you get from that human interaction.
It is, and some of the stuff as well is like when you've got an 11 versus 11, you know, we talked about organisation logistics as one of the competencies. Well, the organisation takes care of itself. You've got a full size pitch, you've got 22 players, you know, goalkeeper at either end and a ball. Now you're going to coach within that. There's no thought has to go in necessarily to the actual structure of the session. You might plan, I would like to start here under these sort of circumstances. But if you've suddenly got three kids who want to come out and work on defending in wide areas, now you've got to think about the physical parameters they're working within, what are the technical considerations you want, what's the loading going to be like, what are the areas, what's relevant as a target for them to, if they win the ball, what do? They just stop? That challenges you as a coach in a completely different way. And that's why I think you can derive as much joy and value from that as you can from doing a big 11v11. And ultimately, you know, I know when we were coaching, starting out coaching, people started using the term contextual interference, you know, as closer to the game. Well, 11v11 is the ultimate contextual interference, which is why I think people shy away from it a little bit. But the reality is, whenever you're dealing with it, there's normally a couple of players that are really important in any one situation. Then there's a few others that you need to affect a little bit. And then the rest you just give what I call a little tweak, and that's the whole thing done.
Yeah.
So it's not as complicated as it sounds, really.
So that's that pattern recognition of knowing what to ignore, so that you can focus on the important things, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really. And if you structure your 11v11 and you get the ball in the right area of the field, as long as you're not too prescriptive about exactly what it's going to look like, it will, you know, something will crop up that you can use as your start point.
Yeah.
And you know, and if not, you can always put a ball in a situation, say, right, put the ball there, fellas, you know, play, and then you get the session started. So it's quite easy.
Panathinaikos, tell us a little bit about your experience in Panathinaikos, because, you know, not everybody is brave enough, gets the opportunity or grasps the opportunity to go and work at that level, certainly, and outside the comfort zone of your own language as well. So what was that like, Steve?
Well, it is outside the comfort in terms of it's in Greece, but the reality is that there's 14 different nationalities there, and everybody speaks English or tries to, because that's the default language.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of a safety net with that. I obviously went, you know, because the head coach there had been on the English coaching courses, and that's how I met him. And I went as his assistant, but also as his experience on the shoulder, really.
Yeah.
So it was quite a nice sort of arrangement. A big club, you know, obviously Olympiacos are big. The games between the two are just phenomenal experiences, unbelievable experiences to be involved in.
Atmosphere and stuff,
Oh, they call it the Derby of the Eternal Enemies.
Is it hostile?
Oh, unbelievable. And there's no away fans.
No
away fans, because the chance of violence.
Right.
I know when they controlled Greek football to a large degree.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a number of issues that obviously have been well documented. But in the time we were there, we played them four times, we beat them twice, and we lost twice.
Right.
And we had a positive goal difference. So to have done that with our budget was phenomenal. But I have to say that Yanni, the lad I went to work with, Yanni Anastasio, he had those qualities we spoke about. You know, the emotional intelligence, magnificent, and he could get performances out of people. People just liked him and wanted to work for him, you know. So he was brilliant.
So
to work
were you
with.
And him, in hindsight now, would you say we were a good team because you had a different skill set than he had, or was stronger in certain areas?
He said to me, like, I want you to come, A, because I know you're a really good field coach and you've got much more experience of that than I have. He said, but B, I want you to watch me and tell me what I'm doing wrong.
So when you were there, Steve, were you the person who did the coaching, essentially?
Yanni did a lot. Yeah, and to be fair, I always had an arrangement with Yanni that I said, look, if you're out on the pitches, you coach. Because there's this deferential thing with the head coach on the pitch. If the assistant coach is working, all the players are still looking at the head coach.
So I
said, look, if you're going to be here, you coach, because it's pointless me doing it.
Yeah.
You know, because then if you step in over the top, A, it undermines me, and you know, they want to listen to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But we had a brilliant relationship, and we still do. I mean, I worked with him at three clubs. And I say he had those four qualities. And people want to work with him and want to, you know, they want to work for him.
Yeah.
So it was a really good opportunity. I'd never worked at that level. The first year we managed to put a side together on a really low budget. We won the FA Cup, which in front of like 60,000, which
brilliant.
Was phenomenal.
Yeah.
We qualified for the Champions League playoffs, and then eventually ended up in the Europa League the following season in the group stage of the Europa League. I've never had those experiences if I'd have stayed in England.
Brilliant. Yeah. That's brilliant. Yeah. So, okay, let's just touch on your time at the FA, just in terms, obviously you've told us a little bit about that. If you look back, Steve, at your time educating coaches, what's your opinion, if I can use that word, of how the coach education system in this country has progressed or developed or evolved since, you know, from the time you started to perhaps where it is now, and ultimately what do you think you would do if you had, you know, a magic wand to kind of take it to the next level?
I think
I know there's a lot in there, but
I mean, from my experiences, I thought when I was at the FA, I thought over time with the help of a lot of people we put together what for me was a very coherent, a very logical and a very well thought out system of education. It's never perfect, always need to tweak. I went abroad, I've been away say 4.5 years, I came back, I spent a period working at Yeovil as the head of coaching in the academy.
Yeah.
I'm fed up of the coaches coming back and saying nobody teaches anything anymore.
Right.
It's all about, well, what's your experience? My concern is that in a rush to sort of like appease everybody and make everybody happy, the whole process of learning things and being assessed against standards seems to have gone out the window. And it seems much more now, it's just, you know, you just have to rationalise why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
you know, for example, you've got foundation phase coaches who are coaching 9-year-olds on the A licence, which is a course designed even under the latest UEFA criteria for working at the top level of the game.
Yeah.
Well, as far as I'm aware, at the top level of the game, they play 11 versus 11 on a full-size pitch.
Yeah.
You're not dealing with a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
So how can a coach of an under-9s team go on the A licence and get the badge
and be competent,
when they go back to their club and they're coaching 9-year-olds?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's impossible for me. But I'm not in charge of it anymore. So, yeah. I think that's long term. Yeah. I think it's doing a massive disservice to coach education in this country.
Yeah. So, as somebody who myself who's been through that process and gone through an assessment, not passed, gone away for 3.5 years and done sessions week in, week out, at university sides, at non-league sides, at, you know, all stages of town on a Tuesday and a Thursday with 8 players when they turn up, and you need 16 to do your pay, you know, to do whatever you need to do. I recognise that. So do you think that in order to, what can I say, to progress things, that there needs to be a review of standards, if that's the right word, or is it something that's just, is it just the evolution of time? Because I think in education itself, never mind in sports education or football education, for me, having people in my work area of work come through who are newly qualified, they often come through with different grades. That nobody not gets through, everybody gets through, but some get through with a you're okay and you're a bit better and you're a bit better. It's almost wrong to actually tell somebody that they're not up to standard, Steve. That's how it seems to be.
Listen, people who just say we're getting old and grumpy. I listen to all the people now in education talking about the key factors in people's achievements, you know, qualities of resilience, a growth mindset. You know, they quote Carol Dweck and all the research and then they do absolutely everything they can to ever avoid making anybody ever overcome any obstacle. You know, like you say, everybody's competent. You know, I'll come back and watch you 6 times and eventually I'll pass you even if you're not any better.
Yeah.
Because actually I want you to feel good about yourself. Well, you know, my reality, people said to me, I did an A-licence course presentation as a guest speaker, and I asked the group, I said, how many of you think it's appropriate that A-licence level you should be assessed, physically assessed by a tutor on the side of the pitch in a session in order to be competent? And I think a class of about 42 put their hand up and the rest didn't. And I said, well, let me tell you now from my experiences, you're an idiot if you don't think you're being assessed every time you step across the white line to do a coaching session. Yeah. And I gave them an example at Panathinaikos when I was there. You know, I've coached on coach education, you've been on the courses, I'm not name dropping, but I've delivered on courses where, you know, people like Zola and Peter Beardsley and Gus Poyet and all sorts of Champions League winners and all sorts. So, yeah, okay. But as coaches, now I'm coaching a team of players at Panathinaikos, and I did the evaluation after our first away game, which we lost 3-0 against another Athens team called Panionios. And so I did the video analysis and everything the following morning, and we went out onto, and as we went out onto the pitch, two Swedish lads, Swedish internationals, Marcus Berg, who played against England in the World Cup just recently, was one of the two. And they put their arms around my shoulders as we walked out, and they said, we're really glad you did that. And I said, well, why are you glad? And they said, well, because now we know that you know what you're doing. So what they're basically saying is, like, we're listening to see what you're going to say, and if you say anything rubbish, we're not having you.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And so that's what they said. So I was being assessed. So you know, my riposte after 3 paces was, bearing in mind we lost 3-0 and played so badly, when will I know that you know what you're doing?
Yeah. Now you know that I know what I'm doing.
At which point Marcus said, yeah, good point.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I'm saying is, that was just an example of them saying, listen, just because you're the coach, we ain't taking everything you say for granted. You tell us some rubbish, you know, and we'll let you know. So these people, they're not used to being assessed, they're not used to dealing with failure, and yet everybody goes on about a growth mindset, resilience being the key consideration, their self-motivation. You know, do you have to keep telling people they're good to make them motivated? Because if you do, in the world of football, they're not going to last very long.
Yeah. So in reality, Steve, if what we're talking about is reality, and it is reality to me, because I've known colleagues who come back from the A-licence and actually coming back unimpressed by their experience, because they've been asked questions and they want to be supplied with or facilitated to find the knowledge or guided and inspired, and they're actually feeling that they're having to go and actually create the knowledge themselves. So actually, yes, we the education system might be getting the numbers through, which on paper looks impressive, but actually, if what the example you've talked about, when all those people do decide or get the opportunity to go in front of players, then they're going to get found out. If you only coach under 10s and you've only ever done two 11v11 sessions, I don't see how you can be competent at it.
Well, I think that's the point, isn't it? It's how you view it and what you see it as being for. Because I know people quoted the Spanish, and years ago the Spanish said exactly that. You know, we pass them all and the game will sort them out. Well, I don't think you'd be doing that with an anaesthetist or an airline pilot.
No.
I mean, you know, I've never actually passed my flying exams, but I fancy having a go. You know, are you going to sit in the plane or are you going to try and get
up? You're not
going to
have a go now.
So it's whether or not you see it as a real profession. You know, for me, there are, as I said before, there's a range of things you can do that are acceptable. People have to know the basic standards that they've got to achieve in order to get to the next level.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no point in having levels of courses. If you can do a session at A licence level and get a pass coaching 9-year-olds that you can also do at level 2 and get a pass, then to me, where's the differentiation? Where's the increase in knowledge base, increase in pedagogical skill, the increase in emotional intelligence? There isn't. Yeah. So what challenges it ultimately towards the A license? And it does say even in the latest UEFA convention, it's at football at the highest levels of the game. And as I said earlier, that's 11 versus 11 with adults, with the ball moving quickly, and you have to solve the problems in the split second.
Yeah, and I remember you saying on one of the courses, Steve, I don't know whether it was one of the ones I was a student on or I was working on, you said to me, by the end of this, you should be able, if we dropped you off at Melwood at 9:30 on a Monday morning for the, and you know, Julier said, isn't the reserve team coach isn't in today, can you just do a session? You should, after this course, be able to, and you've got your ticket, go and just put a session on and be confident that yes, you might be nervous at the fact that you don't know the players, but you know, put that aside, you should be able to do that.
And they're not necessarily going to have to say that's the best session I've ever had in my life. What they've got to say is that's a session that is within the range of competence I would expect of that coach.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. If you know, like, if it's about 11-a-side coaching and you only ever coach little uns doing 4-a-side, and suddenly you get thrown into an 11-a-side, the chances are you're going to make a pig zero.
You're going to be stumped. Yeah.
Well, you only get one chance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and if you're in the professional game and that's where you want to work, that's it. The players, you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, forget it. You ain't going back out, because anything you do from then on, they've got no respect for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Obviously, recently, I think that's the last time we hooked up was when we were at Dick's funeral.
Yeah, Dick's funeral.
And obviously, you know, you've already mentioned that Dick was one of your mentors, and I kind of knew that in a way via you know, speaking to you in the past, Steve. So just for the people who are listening who haven't had the good fortune of being able to spend time around Dick, do you want to just perhaps share a little bit about why Dick was great at what he did and how he inspired you and what it was, you know, about him that kind of influenced you in your career, really?
Yeah, I suppose we're back to the same points, really. Same with Brian, you know, the four competencies.
Yeah.
But there was something about Dick. He was more known in the coach education world than Brian would have been, for example. Yeah. So Brian was very particular to me. Dick, I think, is more global in terms of his appeal and his reputation. I think the thing, after he died, I spoke to lots of people around the world who knew him. And again, the first thing all of them said was, "Oh, what a great fella," you know. And Dick had this brilliant way of doing things, and his attention to detail. And
scary.
I mean, some of his PowerPoint presentations, I've never seen so many colours on one slide in my life.
My dude.
Green writing on a purple background.
What about his position specific?
But the man was an encyclopedia of football, and his passion was, you know, was undimmed by the years. You know, he was still the same as when I first met him. And I can remember the first time I ever met him, actually, was after David Burnside left the FA regional job in South West, and we had a couple of temporary ones, and then a couple of lads down there, Alan Gillette, myself, we all fancied ourselves for the job, and because we'd been supporting the system.
Yeah.
And anyway, they appointed this fella called Dick Bate. And so we're driving up to this first seminar at Millfield School, and we're sort of saying, well, he better be good, you know what I mean? And after the seminar, we got in the car to drive back, and I just looked at Gilly and I said, he'll do.
that said it all.
Absolutely. Oh, he'll do. It's just magnificent. And when you go around the world and you realise the esteem that he's held in all corners of the globe, you know, it's unbelievable. He was just the most wonderful fella. His knowledge was encyclopedic. His mannerisms were beyond reproach. You know, he was just brilliant. And he did. He just inspired you. He just inspired you to get better. And, you know, not just me, but there's a young lad called Kev Nicholson. Kev must be like 32, 33 now.
Well, wasn't he his first youth award? Advanced Youth Award.
Yeah, the Advanced Youth Award. He was also on the Elite Coaches badge. But, you know, almost like a different generation to me, but holds him in exactly the same sort of esteem, you know, and he's a sad loss to the game. And I really felt that, although, you know, I'm off to St George's Park tomorrow and the FA are naming a training pitch after him, which is, to be fair, the least I think the National Association could do, I really felt that he should have been, a long time ago, he should have been in charge of coach education and player development in this country, because he was just head and shoulders above anybody else. Maybe people say some of his, you know, some of the way he did stuff wasn't quite in keeping with modern trends, but not everything that's new is good, you know. If it's not broke, don't fix it. And Dick had so much value for everybody. It's a massive, massive loss, and I think he's irreplaceable. He's a one-off.
And all his knowledge that he's left behind, Steve. Yeah, I believe you've taken on a little bit of a project.
Maggie asked us to try and sort it out, because, you know, there's so much there. You know, you don't want to just lose it. So we're trying to preserve it the best we can. I've got five lads helping me. Kev Nicholson's one of them, but a few other lads: Jim Hicks from the PFA, Kenny Swain, and Dennis Mortimer are coming in as well to help out. And between us all, we're gonna try and go through his archive of stuff, and then try and coordinate it in some sort of usable resource, and then try and do something with it so that other people in future generations can benefit from it.
Brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. So, okay, just moving on from that then, Steve. Where are you now, kind of in your own coaching journey, and what's kind of, is there anything, you know, what's next for Steve?
Well, if there's anybody listening who has a very nice job going, I am available. At the moment, I've just recently signed a consultancy agreement with the Asian Football Confederation. They contacted me the other day with a first engagement to go and do some stuff. I'm talking to a couple of other people about permanent jobs, because I'm not really sure where I'm going to go. A lot depends on opportunity, obviously. But when I left the FA in 2013 to go into club football, it was because I felt I needed to get some contemporary experience of coaching players. Because my experiences of coaching teams and players is 10 years old. And I've done that now 4.5 years. I've done it in Greece, I did it in Holland and Belgium in the top divisions. So I feel like going back into coach education now would be something I'd like to do. Whether that's with one permanent job or as a consultant for a number of agencies, I don't know yet. But the other thing, I've got a growing family as well. My lad's just signed a scholarship at Swansea, so he's just started his scholarship there. So I want to see him play if possible. But I just want to be, you know, football's in our blood, isn't it? We can't
moan about it.
It whacks you down a few times, you know, but you come back to it. And I have to be honest, given from where I started as a very average player coming off a council estate in Northampton, playing for Wellingborough Town at the Dog and Duck, you know, I've not had a bad career out of it. As I say, I may not have the money of Villas Boas, but I've certainly enjoyed my life so far, and long may it continue.
Okay, great. And just to kind of finish off with a couple of things. Young coaches out there, or whether they're young or old, but they're starting out and on a journey at whatever level, maybe they've got ambitions to go to the next level, or to, you know, go on, what would be your top couple of tips that you'd say to people who are out there coaching, you know, night after night, indoor, outdoor youngsters?
But that's the thing, you know, be ambitious, but don't delude yourself. That's the problem. And what I have found is there's this rush to get to where they want to be at the end point, you know. And I think it's society in general. You get all these reality TV shows and everybody wants instant stardom and instant fame, don't they? You've got to do the groundwork. If you want to be really good at something, you know, the 10,000 hour rule is a myth, really. You know, because for some people it might be 4,000 hours, for other people it might be 25,000 hours, and they never get there. But if you want to be good at something, the chances are you've probably got to have a little bit of natural talent, but you've got to invest an awful amount of time and effort to make yourself as good as you can be. And like you said earlier about the places you'd coach, the different environments you've been in, go and test yourself in different environments. You know, if you want to know about emotional intelligence, go and coach a group of 8-year-olds, you know, when you're tying their shoelaces and wiping their noses, and then go and coach a men's non-league team where everybody's effing and blinding, and then go and coach a girls' team, and then go and coach a professional club. Put yourself
test
in a mixed
yourself.
Environment. Test yourself. Yeah, challenge yourself, because you'll find a chink in your armour somewhere.
Yeah.
And you can either run away from it or you can deal with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eventually, like for me, what I found, having had two goes as a manager, was I wasn't a manager.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I did it in Yeovil, then I did it in San Juan Jablotay in Trinidad. I'm not a manager.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I should have learnt my lesson the first time. Maybe I'm thick. Took me two goes.
Yeah, yeah.
But challenge yourself. Go and practice the thing. Find out what niche suits
what your niche.
You.
Yeah, yeah.
And then work as hard as you can to be good at that niche.
And be happy in it, yeah?
Happy in it. Enjoy what you do.
Yeah, you know?
And it's... Being happy is not all about the financial rewards and that. It's about the... Sometimes it's the intrinsic challenge. Listen, if you can do a job you like and somebody's going to pay you a lot of money, that's probably better than doing a job you like when
not
they don't pay
paid.
You at
all.
But there are times in your life when you do A and times in your life when you do B.
Yeah.
And you know, nobody has this like linear, perfect world where they just go from A to B to C to D. So expect some setbacks. We spoke earlier with growth mindset, dealing with adversity, you know, resilience. Be prepared for it. You know, and that's, again, back to the courses. If you go on a course, you know, you really want it to test you. You really want it to challenge you.
Yeah.
If you take a role somewhere, a job, you want it to test you. You want it to challenge you.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, how are you going to grow? How are you going to get better?
Yeah.
Be prepared to get some slaps in the face, because you're going to make some mistakes, you're going to make yourself look stupid, and then you just brush yourself down and get on again.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so we've talked about Steve the coach and Steve the manager and Steve the player. So just to finish off, we'll do a couple of quick questions about the person. So Steve, as a person, I'm probably going to drop these on you actually. So have you got a favourite film? A film that really inspires you, or you really like, or you watch 10 times?
Actually, I've watched lots of films lots of times. The Killing Fields, I really like.
Yeah.
All the Bourne films.
Yeah, yeah.
Are fantastic. And Shrek.
You like them?
Shrek.
Yeah.
Oh, Shrek's magnificent.
Yeah, yeah.
The humour level in Shrek is like adults, kids. It's brilliant. I can watch it time and time again and still laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, and probably my wife won't thank me for saying this, but Pink Panther films. Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther films. Classic.
It's just your sense of humour. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, she can't watch them. She just shuts the door and leaves me in there.
Yeah. Okay. Book. Is there anything that you think, you know, if you... I know you're a reader. I know you're that kind of... Have you got anything...
I love reading. Particularly at the moment, I'm massively into things like neural processing, decision making, what makes you make the decisions you make, pattern recognition, all those sorts of things. Prowse was a neuroscientist. Was a really good book, so I'd recommend that if anybody's out there,
what's that
called? Well, Proust was a neuroscientist,
right?
Yeah, and it just talks about like different things, the way people do things that actually they don't even realise. You know, Le Guide Culinaire, the cookbook, Auguste Escoffier. You know how clever he was years before anybody realised it. He realised that eating was more than just a taste sensation.
Yeah,
it was all about the ambience of the place, the weight of the knives and forks, and how you can influence people through...
Yeah, brilliant.
Affecting their thinking, basically.
Okay, music, anything that you like? Or you
very,
eclectic?
Very eclectic. Very eclectic. I don't like too much of anything.
Yeah.
But a little bit of everything, to be honest. And I think Adele has got an amazing voice.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. Well, Steve, unless there's anything else you want to chuck in as a last bit of advice to young coaches or managers, then, you know, I'll let you get on your way, and thank you very much for your time, because it's been great.
So I suppose your only advice is don't do an interview in the motorway service.
Yeah, we're all kids shouting and screaming.
Absolutely.
Okay,
but
brilliant.
No, brilliant. Thanks,
all
Rob.
Right, thanks very much, Steve. Okay, thank you very much. And hope you've enjoyed that, folks. That's Steve Rutter. Tons and tons of information there. Absolutely fantastic stuff. So take it away, enjoy, and I'll catch you later.